Caleb Parsons is 6'9 swing man. You can shoot the three.
Urban Meyer, a liar. Don't believe a word he said.
Look at you go. Look at that. It's like seeing a kid ride a bike.
And I'm going to law school, baby. It all starts here.
Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Thursday, July 30th, 2009. I'm your host, Adam Berry. Once again, back in our studio, quote unquote, here in the Alligator office. And joining me today is Phil Kegler.
Studio is a bit of a stretch. Nice, sad, rainy day here in Gainesville.
Yeah, and we're in a new studio, technically, so we have a window out into the sad, rainy day. So between that and the roughly 30 minutes of audio test we just inefficiently ran here, I think we're all in a great mood for podcasting. But we do have a fair amount of stuff to talk about. We're going to talk about Friday Night Lights, which occurred last week. I just want to, you know, get some of the reaction to that. I was there covering it, so I'll give some of my experiences from that. We're going to talk about the UF men's basketball team's out-of-conference schedule. It's certainly interesting, especially after last year. They've scheduled some real teams this year, which I think will inspire some interesting debate. Then after the break, we're going to talk about some of the burning questions, the top 10 burning questions of 2009, 2010 that we are running through in our paper. We've revealed 10 through 5 so far, and I know the guys at SEC Media Days broke down 10 and 9 last time, so we're going to run through 8 through 5. And we'll give out our weekly awards, and we'll get out of here and out into the rainy weather of Gainesville. But let's start with Friday Night Lights. I was there covering it. Phil, you were not, as you were so proud of, because recruiting to us is not that big of a deal. It's not something that we take a lot of interest in ourselves. Would you agree to that?
Yeah, I'd agree. But I mean, again, as you can see from the views on our website and some of the comments, fans really dig their recruiting, especially in the football sense, more than the basketball sense. So tell me, what was Friday Night Lights like? I've never been there. What kind of fans could go? Is there a big fan presence?
Yeah, I'd say there were a couple hundred fans, maybe 400 or 500 fans there. It was in the swamp, obviously. It was open to the public and everything, which is interesting. You know, fans got to come to the swamp. They had the new video boards running, which I said there were two interesting, you know, two like really exciting, impressive things going on at Friday Night Lights, one of whom was a player. We'll get to him later. And the other were the video boards in the swamp. The one in the south end zone is unbelievable. Like, it had, on the left side, it had, like, a running scoreboard, or it had the box score, the final score of the FSU game, which was just kind of like a hearty, you suck to FSU, basically. And the right side was a running scoreboard of every game from the national championship season, except for Ole Miss, I believe. That was...
How about that?
And then the middle was a highlight reel from last season, which I believe they did last year from what I remember. But this year it was like on that huge screen. It's so impressive. It's like a, you know, it's better than a movie theater screen in every way. It's great. And everybody was impressed. You'd see Urban Meyer, who was there, and a lot of the players, because a lot of players made their way out there. Every once in a while, they just get wrapped up watching the screens or whatever. They look at the recruits, and then they like look around, and they look up, and then they just spend the next 2 or 3 minutes like eyes captivated on the highlights from the last season. So that was interesting. It was quite a spectacle. Obviously, you know, the fans show up for that. They're interested. There's 200-odd players running drills out in the swamp. It's not... When we say camp, it's a camp. Like, they run drills with the UF coaches. They're not out there scrimmaging or whatever. Like, you know, quarterbacks throw passes to receivers and the linemen go up against each other. But it's drills at its heart, so...
Right, but it's just one day or one night. Like, it's such a small affair, and players come from all over, it seems like.
Yeah, as one of the other guys, the one who I teased before as being the most impressive, was a guy named Ronald Powell, who I wrote about, defensive end from out in California, one of the best prospects in the nation and everything. And this was his second trip to Gainesville. So he made his second trip to Gainesville from what I understand, is roughly a 5-hour event in the swamp. And, you know, what we were able to see was them out in the field running the drills and everything, but they get the tour of the stadium. They go talk to the coaches. They run through the weight rooms and everything. I believe... Coach Marotti runs them through like a typical weight training program that, you know, that they go through if they played there. So it's a really big spectacle. It's about like see the program, not just like go train or whatever. It's like it's a huge recruiting tool that obviously pays off very well, as when I was there, one player recruited and then afterward another one, or committed I should say, and afterward another one committed as well. The one who committed there was a running back named Mac Brown from Georgia. Actually, there was a controversy whether or not he was going to go to Georgia or not. Florida won him away. He thought his friends were going to give him a hard time for that. I don't feel particularly bad for him. He's going to be a pretty good player here at Florida. And then the other one was a defensive end who committed a couple days after Friday Night Lights, named Nayron Bell, who I believe is also from Georgia.
Yes, Jackson, Georgia.
All right, so two Georgia guys, you know, expanding the reach. And both saw some stuff they liked at Friday Night Lights. I had the opportunity to talk to Mac Brown, who didn't actually run any drills out there, so I didn't get to see him, you know, see him out there, which, honestly, I don't know what all I could have gained from seeing him take fake handoffs and run around a couple of cones or whatever, but, you know, I was able to talk to him, get a feel for him, and he said the most interesting thing to me was that, you know, he sees the offense changing in the future at Florida, and he's more of an all-around guy, more of a versatile guy, and he sees himself fitting more in an I-formation system, which is what he told me, and he said that Dave, you know, the coordinators or whatever, showed him about 40 plays in the I form that, you know, that they're going to implement in the offense once Brantley takes over, which certainly interesting. I mean, you could see that happening, right? You could see that.
Yeah, I mean, Urban's big thing is all about using his players in the scenarios that makes the most allows them to best use their skills. Yeah. So obviously for John, that's probably going to John Brantley. That's probably going to be more of an I form type offense. Than necessarily what they run for Tim now. And it's not like this is really the first glimpse. Like, there's been some rumblings kind of that it's going to be that way, both from spring practice and the I formation talk. And there was a quarterback prospect a couple months ago that was quoted on ESPN, I don't have the name in front of me, that said that, you know, he was kind of told that they're going to go to a more of a pro style or an I form offense as opposed to the spread kind of thing they run now. I think it'll be interesting. Like, you see it from the running back prospects, you know, like Mac Brown, and now I believe it was a quarterback that said that's not shocking. You have John Brantley coming.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to see, like, what other changes kind of you want to see from that.
I talked to Trey Burton, who is, you know, he's more recruiter than recruit for Florida. He's a 2010 oral commit. You know, there is literally no doubt he will be here come 2010. Like, he wants to be a Gator more than anybody in that group. So he's, you know, he's sort of on the inside. He talks with Meyer and everything. And he said to me, which I thought was weird when I asked him about Mac Brown, he said, like, we're going to have an awesome option game when Burton says he's going to take over at quarterback after Brantley and Brown. And I thought that was a little unusual because you can't, you know, you can't picture Florida after the last couple of years running an option. But it does show sort of how Urban would be willing to adapt his style of coaching to the different players he's going to get. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm buying an option game here in Florida. But, I mean, anything's really possible. I think it'll just kind of depend. The thing is, though, it's like, in a little bit of a sense, Urban kind of has to, like, be thinking about it for the future, because if you recruit players according to one system, or you recruit some players for one system and some players for another system, either somebody's going to have to be convert over, or
yeah,
you're just going to have not people in the right spots.
Yeah, that's true. But Brown, from what I can tell from, you know, watching his highlights and reading up about him and, you know, asking him, you know, about his game and everything, he's more versatile. He can do whatever. Like, he can run downhill. He's, the video I watched him, it's always, you know, he gets hit and he keeps going forward. He never does that. He's not as much side to side, not quite as shifty as the Demps Rainey types, but he's very much a downhill runner. I hope for his sake he's not quite as doomed as Emmanuel Moody is in this system as a downhill runner, but from what I can also tell, he's shifty, he's quick, he's not, you know, Demps speed or whatever, but he can move around, so Urban will find a use for him, I believe, after, you know, whether it's after Demps and Rainey are gone, he gets a year or two, or, you know, even if it's, you know, it's the third running back and whatever mix happens there.
Right, yeah, I mean, that'd be, I mean, Demps, Rainey, as we've kind of talked about, never usually seem like the big every down kind of guys.
Yeah.
So if you have, you know, I think Emmanuel's going to get a little bit, Moody's going to get some more carries this year anyway, and then you bring Mac Brown into the mix, I mean, anything could happen. The one thing I want to go back to just a little bit, which I find fascinating that we really had that many answers, but the guy, the pal,
Ronald Powell.
Right. Defensive end, correct?
Yeah.
And where he caught some passes too. But I mean, this is really, I mean, it's just got to be tough because if I remember correctly, like, schools can't pay for these people to come out here because it'd be, you know, big NCAA recruiting violations. So, I mean, you got to feel kind of the strain on these families. We don't know what kind of background he comes from. But he's coming all the way up from California twice.
Yeah.
And he's flying, I'm assuming flying because that would be a ridiculous drive, flying from California for a night. I mean, if on one hand, you know, bad for his family, but on the other hand, that really speaks to just how big of a deal Friday Night Lights is.
Absolutely. It's one of the biggest camps like this in the nation, which is shown by how many people are out there, you know, how many people use it as, you know, a judge of talent and everything. But since you brought up Powell, I was waiting for it. I was just, you know, I wanted a section to go off on Ronald Powell here. He is the most impressive high school player, just physically, that I can ever think of seeing. Like, he is built like a junior in college right now. He's incredibly impressive. He lined up on both sides of the ball. He was at, you know, linebacker, at defensive end, at receiver slash tight end. he said when he talked to the Florida coaches, they could see playing him on both sides of the ball, which would be ridiculous, but I think if there's one guy to do it, it would be him. I can't describe how impressed I was by him.
Yeah, no, I mean, you talked him up highly when you came back from that. I've just heard so many people say they're going to play inside the ball, and they want to play on both sides of the ball, and I just, you know, I'm just not seeing it. I'll believe it when it actually happens.
He'd settle in eventually, I think, if he wanted more pro prospects to the defensive end, to the defensive end spot, because that's where I think he's physically better to line up at, and he, you know, he didn't look all that great catching passes at Friday Night Lights. I mean, I'd say he looked better than a quarter of the receivers there, the natural receivers there, I'd say. But when he lined up even at linebacker against, you know, running backs running out to take short passes, he was so impressive. Like, he was batting stuff down better than most of the linebackers in attendance.
Right. Well, I mean, it'll be interesting to see, though, in a little bit of a sense, what they do at tight end. Because, you know, you figure Aaron Hernandez possibly might be gone after this year.
Yes.
He's going into his junior season, and he's certainly highly touted. But even if he stays one more year, if he stays for 2010, I mean, right now his backup is Desmond Parks. And for next year, they do have two tight ends. Let me pull these up here. Two tight ends that have orally committed, Gerald Christian from West Palm Beach and Michael McFarland from Tampa. But neither of them are really McFarland's the 23rd best tight end, and Christian's the 5th best tight end in the country.
Yeah.
So that'd be interesting. So yeah, I guess probably Powell. But I mean, I could see him sliding over in one of those, because tight end right now depth isn't really a big thing, and if one of these guys breaks or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. You know, and Urban's not opposed to having multiple tight ends or guys that he can throw in special situations, even. And he would be one of those. You know, you think he's going into block, he ends up catching a pass on a trick play or whatever. So I think he has a lot of potential wherever he plays. As I said, like, he was the center of attention, really, and not just because he was the only guy out on the field without a shirt on. By the way, that's how you know a guy knows he's awesome. He doesn't need the numbers that everybody else wears. We don't identify them by their names or whatever. As media, we're treated like fans at this event by SEC regulations. I believe it all comes down from the SEC office.
Even I think it's even from the NCAA, and the SEC kind of just passes it on.
Okay, yeah. Well, NCAA rules then. Like, you know, we can't, you know, they can't arrange interviews for us. They can't really aid us in any way. They treat us like fans, so we don't get lists of these people. But, you know, we can't identify them by numbers. That's how you, like, you identify them later. It would be a pain to be like, red shorts, blue shirt. No, you just say, like, 190. That's, you know, whoever.
Right.
So, but you know, a guy doesn't care about getting recognized. It doesn't feel like he has a need to be recognized by everybody. But he just goes out there without a shirt on. Only dude out there. But, as I said, that just showed off how physically impressive he was. I said he was some bizarre combination of Cornelius Ingram and Carlos Dunlap, if you want to put that in any sort of perspective as to what a physical freak this guy is.
I mean, that certainly says a lot, because those are two people that they refer to as freaks.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I mean, I was there, and among the other media who were in attendance, I heard him, you know, Javon Curse's name was dropped at one point, which I think in terms of being a physical freak, you can't get much better than a guy whose nickname was the Freak. So, you know, do with that what you will. But it was interesting to see what a hard push Urban and company were making for him, because it seemingly every turn he had Urban watching him, or he was talking with Urban. About halfway through the camp, everybody settled in at midfield, you know, took a knee and watched the highlight reel of last year, like a really, you know, well-made highlight reel. It's different from the other stuff. It wasn't just every play. It was cinematic, I would say, in nature. And all those guys were on their knees in the middle of the field, and in front of the group was Urban standing in the middle, and right next to him was Ronald Powell, watching, talking the whole time. So these two are certainly developing some sort of relationship.
Yeah, I mean, it looks interesting. I pulled up his Rivals page. They've got him as the number one defensive end for the class of 2010 and the third overall player prospect of 2010. But just like his offers, I mean, the list is obviously big, but it's interesting the two teams that Rivals, or the two schools, excuse me, that Rivals says he has, quote, high interest in, are Florida and USC. So that's not surprising for someone who seems to be a guy with a lot of talent.
Absolutely. And he's being pursued by, like, every team in the Pac-10, I think, and a couple SEC schools. I think Notre Dame's on the list.
Yep.
Like, this guy is a legit talent. Everybody knows. He's like a sure thing as far as I'm concerned. So, obviously, Urban's going after him, but...
I don't believe in the concept of sure things out of prospects after
you
Omar Hunter, Frankie Hammond Jr. I'm so tired of people that are sure things that just blow up. John Brown. John Brown's not even at Florida anymore. Stop telling me sure things as prospects.
I would virtually put my name on this guy being a sure thing.
I can't wait for him to bust then.
You would, I trust your word with recruiting at nothing, essentially.
That's fine. You can trust my word on the bust, though.
Well, I mean, like, these guys, how much sure things were they? Were they third best, you know, prospect in the nation or whatever?
John,
was Frankie Hammond the third best prospect?
They were, but John Brown and, who's the other guy I just said? I forgot. I'm losing my name. But John Brown, I'm just going to, you know what? I'm going to pull up, hold the phone. I'm pulling up Florida's recruit list from a couple years ago, and I'm just going to show you the busts that have come here.
Phil brought no information
about
Friday
Night Lights.
Talk
about something else about Friday Night Lights here. Tell me something else.
But to go more about Ronald Powell, this is a little inside information. I hinted at it in the article I wrote. But afterwards, all the recruits, they ate a meal, which was provided by Florida, which I found very interesting. You know, I don't know if they did that last year, but they all sat down at the tables and ate. And there were three female college-age U.S. staffers around him at all times. Like, he did not... He was surrounded by these people who were just, you know, talking to him and, you know, making him laugh, joking around with him. And then when he left, these, you know, two of those girls escorted him out. And this confused me a bit because I don't know, you know, how they're allowed to do this. But they took him into a side room of the swamp once the thing was over. And he has that sort of rock star mentality about him where, you know, he didn't really feel like he needed to talk to the media. So he just, like, he was getting whisked away, and he gave us, like, quick, short, one-word, you know, one-sentence answers and everything about his time there. And it was interesting to watch him. He gets the rock star celebrity. He's a rock star celebrity status already.
All right. The name that I said that I have now, that I had forgotten, Omar Hunter.
Yeah.
Mr. Omar Hunter, who was the class of 08, or, I'm sorry, excuse me, was the class of, yeah, 08, signed January of 2008. Who Urban hyped up to endless degree. I think there may have been a Tim Tebow of the recruiting class comment.
How was he hyped up nationally? I feel like
he was number two
overall.
At his position, number two defensive tackle.
What was he overall? Can you see that?
17.
Oh, that's pretty impressive.
But, I mean,
it's no wrong.
And a D tackle, like defensive tackle, though, is obviously not going to usually garner the praise of an end or even like a skill player. So it's impressive that Powell's number three as defensive end. But Omar Hunter was just supposed to be the next huge thing. Like, teams were going to double-team him every game because he was going to be so massive and such a big deal. And, he did nothing. Throw that out there.
I mean, you can do that with that what you will, but it comes down a lot to, you know, how their work ethic is and everything. And I've seen nothing from Powell that suggests that he's... When you're that physically, like... well-defined and everything, as a 17 or 18-year-old, like, defensive tackles, they can just be big, and that's all you gotta be. You know, you can't train a guy to be big, but you can, you know, work, you know, instill a regime and, you know, an ethic inside yourself to become that physically well-trained and that versatile at different positions and that quick and that strong and everything, which is what I saw with my own eyes, not from the word of Urban or recruiting services, but that's what I saw from Ronald Powell. That's why I said I'm putting my name on it. I'm not putting rivals' names or Urban's name.
It was. I'm just gonna make two disclaimers for you in advance. First, it was one Friday Night Lights camp. I'm very impressive. You can see him in a lot of drills. One night though. Secondly, he still. We'll see how he adapts to the college game. That's all I'm gonna say.
Yeah, that could
be. I mean, drills can say 100 things, but we'll see.
I mean, the adaptation to the college game is always something to look out for. But the people I've compared him to, I'm not comparing him to Omar Hunter. I'm comparing him to legit talents. Like, maybe Carlos Dunlap, you know, hasn't been, you know, he's not leading the country in sacks or whatever, but he's still an impressive player. That's maybe where, that's his low point to me.
Okay. So, we'll see. A couple years.
All right. Anything else you want to know about Friday Night Lights? You want to go by a couple more top players, guys that impressed me out there?
Yeah, sure. Let us drop some knowledge on us here, Adam.
Well, as I said, like, you know, I didn't have a list. I'm not one of the rivals guys or, you know, one of the privileged elite working here at the Alligator when I'm going to Friday Night Lights, so I didn't have a list of names. I'm not a recruiting writer myself or reporter, so I don't have an intimate knowledge of these guys. I couldn't see their faces and recognize them, you know, except for just, except for the cream of the crop, really. So what I did, to me, this makes it all seem a little more honest and a little more, you know, a little more unbiased going in by knowledge of, like, well, that's Chris Dunkley. He must be good, and, you know,
right.
da da da. But I wrote down, as I was taking notes and watching it, the numbers of the people who impressed me by what they showed there, and sort of went back and fact-checked that with, you know, with the numbers that I saw afterward, which I was able to get thanks to a friend who was in attendance. But the guys who impressed me, one of the, in my opinion, probably the most impressive guy there, other than Powell, was Chris Dunkley, a wide receiver, I believe he's from Pahokee. I'd say he's, like I said, probably the second best player there. Maybe even the most impressive other than, I mean, Powell, you know, looked good in every way, but as like a specific position player, Dunkley probably looked the best, you know. Not the best athlete, definitely the best skill player there, I would say. There was some confusion afterwards because a lot of people thought he recruited to Florida, but as I'm leaving, it's like, oh, no, Dunkley didn't recruit, don't worry, didn't commit, don't worry about that. So, you know, I feel like Florida is definitely on top of his list. He's a Pahokee guy, he's from Florida, whatever. I feel like he'll end up here eventually. He's a very impressive player. He's going to be able to do a lot of stuff, stretching the field. Definitely somebody to look out for. Otherwise, Solomon Patton is a guy who was already committed orally for the class of 2010. He was hyped up going in there. I thought he was going to be maybe a little more impressive as a receiver than he was. I see him sort of settling into a Brandon James type role.
Yeah, he seems like a pretty small guy. 5'10", 175.
Yeah, he's not big. I could see him, you know, maybe returning some kicks, doing some sweep type stuff. Not going to be a possession receiver. At best, you know, he's going to run a couple deep routes, you know, make some big plays. But I don't see him settling into any sort of possession receiver type role. So I wouldn't look for him to replace that. If you're going to look for a top two receiver type, Dunkley is who it'll be out of that class. The least impressive group to me there was the quarterback group, which, you know, Florida already has Trey Burton, who, you know, is a three-star guy, but they seem to be banking on him a lot. Maybe that's just because he's such a good recruiter or whatever, but they seem to be banking on him to be successful. But the most impressive guy I saw there was Teddy Bridgewater. He, you know, seemed to have some stuff going on, but other than him, like, nobody at quarterback impressed me at all. It's kind of like, nope, like, these receivers, I feel like, are going to be underrated because of their performance at this camp because the quarterbacks are throwing so poorly to them. But also, Trey Burton didn't work out, so I didn't get the chance to see him play. But, you know, I got a chance to talk to him afterward, as I've mentioned before. And running back, the most impressive prospect there to me was a guy in the class of 2011 named Mike Bellamy. He just overall just looked physically impressive. He's got quick feet. Obviously, I would have loved to have seen him gone up against Mac Brown. But if Mac Brown's going to be the guy of the future for Florida, I don't know where Bellamy would fit in or where his preferences are. A couple other quick hits. Receiver, Sammy Watkins, got to look out for. Offensive line, Ian Silverman, who is already committed to Florida. Very good, huge guy. Definitely going to be a force to be reckoned with on the line after he gets maybe a year or two of conditioning and a little stronger workout training on him.
Yeah, 6'4", 257.
Yeah.
That'll only get bigger in 2 years. So.
Exactly.
Wow.
Chaz Green, another guy, another big guy who impressed me on the offensive line. I already said Ronald Powell, another guy on the D-line. Dominique Easley, who is not committed to Florida. I believe he's on Florida's on his list, maybe his top five list, somebody to look out for. He was very impressed by Florida, I remember hearing as he was leaving. Linebacker, one of the top five most impressive guys there was Jeff Luke. He was getting some hands-on work with some of the Florida coaches as well. I think they're going to take a hard look at him. You know, Florida recruits great linebackers.
Absolutely.
I feel like he would be a natural fit as the outside linebacker, as, you know, when Jelani Jenkins is roaming the interior as well. So look out for him. Trio of defensive backs who were guarding, you know, intercepts a lot of those poor passes thrown by the quarterbacks going up against those receivers. DeMar Dorsey, who has already signed, or orally committed, not signed, with Florida. Victor Hampton, who is also already committed. And LaMarcus Joyner, who is not committed, but keep an eye out for him. I don't know if they're going to be able to get him. I feel like if you've already got two guys coming in that class, trying to think of a third guy when you already have a pretty, you know, you already have a couple of young cornerbacks, I don't know how they'll pick him up.
Do you remember, or can you give us any insight into the guy who did commit, the defensive end, Na'Ron Bell?
I did not get
Ball,
a good look at,
excuse me,
yeah,
Ball.
Na'Ron Ball. I didn't get a great look at him. Honestly, I didn't write down his number or anything. He didn't stand out to me, so.
He didn't pass that Barry eye test.
He didn't
so
pass
I'm a little scared.
Yeah, he didn't pass the eye test. Like, I spent most of my time watching the receivers.
Skill
and
players.
The
yeah,
teams.
I
yeah.
think it's usually easier to pick out.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, the linemen were just in a big clump in the north end zone running the drills together, which is why I also did not personally see the infamous U incident that we have on tape. Digital tape, I suppose, at alligatorsports.org, if you want to check that out. That was That was interesting. That was one of the biggest stories to break out of there that I myself did not observe, which really speaks to how much of a circus that camp is, that, like, some huge thing can be happening down at one end of the field and the information just doesn't travel on down. Certainly something interesting about the camp as a whole, but, I mean, the guys in Miami commit. What did you expect from them? Like, it's coming to do the chomp? Like...
Well, no, I mean, I think there's a level of respect, though, if you're a high school kid and you're, like, you don't really need to, like, commit some kind of hate. I mean, like, I don't really have a problem with it in a a small little thing, the reports I heard, he did it once, a Florida assistant coach spoke to him about it, and they did it again, and if you look at the video on our website, it's not like this little, like, casual, like, I'm going to flash at you because I got past or stopped someone that no one else could. He, like flashes it, like, stops, like, looks up at the moon, kind of, and, like, gestures with his body.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's obvious it was a little bit more than a little, you know, a slight little jab.
It was exaggerated. I understand kicking him out, like...
Especially after, if they had spoken to him and did it again, then no reason for
that. Doing it a second time is inexcusable, and, like, you know... The thing to me, the reason they gave is stupid, saying he was a safety concern for all the other people there. Unless a fight was about to break out because they were tired of this Miami kid doing, you know, flashing the U, then I don't understand it personally. I feel like they just wanted to get him out of there because he was representing another school and, you know, Lord forbid he recruit for Miami at a Florida camp.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not Florida's job to, like, allow some kid to recruit for Miami at their own camp.
Yeah.
Like, flash to you. I mean, you ask him, he does it anyway, all right, see you. Like, I mean, it's like you're here at, you know, from Florida's perspective, it's like you're here at our camp. What are you doing, kid?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That is a good point about that. But it's pretty much all I have about Friday Night Lights. It was an interesting experience for me. I actually enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would. I went in personally dreading it because recruiting, as I've said, is not my thing. But once you go in there and you sort of get a viewpoint of what's going on, you see the most impressive guys, you know, you let the circus die down just a little bit. Then it turned out to be a very cool event to cover. So we're going to move on from that. We're going to talk about the UF men's basketball team. Their non-conference schedule was released earlier this week, and it is pretty impressive. I got to say, I wrote a column about it for Thursday's paper. Overall, very impressed by some of the risks they're taking, I guess I would say. You know, even though I can't imagine Billy Donovan has a great deal of confidence in this team to, like, you know, soar through the non-conference schedule, even the conference schedule, he's recruiting some tough games, and he seems like he's committed to at least turning the program back around by making his players better and not trying to shelter them from tough games.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's as we wrote in the headline for your column today, it's a step in the right direction for the Gators. I mean, they got FSU, Michigan State, Syracuse, and UMass for Rutgers. I mean, those are all games that, you know, ESPN or someone will show. Like, they'll make highlights. It won't be on the bottom line. Florida defeats Podunk School.
Florida Gulf
number
Coast.
One. Yeah, I mean, I don't. Let's see, that's four games, right? So you got FSU, Michigan State, Syracuse, and UMass or Rutgers. It's like a bracket style.
That's during the fall, yeah.
Yeah, it's during the fall, right? And Xavier. So that's we
Xavier's
got five games.
One, yeah.
How many? Well, those are probably the top five games. NC State. We never really know how good they're going to be.
Yeah, that's
top
at
five.
NC State though, which is kind
it's
of
at
it's
NC State.
It's a home game.
Oh, yeah, they've been doing it.
Yeah.
It's a little while. Five games. How many think they're going to win?
Two or three at best. Like,
right.
It depends on how this team develops. Like, they could very well come away with that win, because the Xavier game is at home. So
in the middle of the SEC
in the middle of the SEC season. So if this team develops through those fall games, and, you know, maybe they get their butts handed to them a little bit, and they learn a little bit about themselves, and they learn their weaknesses, and are able to capitalize on that, it should help Billy coach better. You'd think if he sees what he can, you know, if he sees what teams can exploit in his team, you'd think he'd be able to come back and we wouldn't have all these issues with the lineup that we talked about so frequently on this podcast in the spring. So I think they come away with two or three.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly by the Xavier game in mid-February, the Gators will definitely know what they have. I mean, that's for sure. I don't think this year.
I'd argue they didn't, yeah.
Well, there's a lot of issues.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is the Michigan State, UMass, or Rutgers thing, that's in that the Legends Classic, right?
Yeah.
So those games will be in back-to-back nights,
mm-hmm.
Neutral site, although if they play Rutgers, that's kind of nearby.
Yeah.
So is Massachusetts, really. But it'll be interesting to see them play on back-to-back nights, not something you do a lot in college basketball.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, they have in a couple tournaments here and there, especially early season tournaments.
They did it, yeah, this year in, was it St. Louis, I believe?
Yes.
Yeah, they did it.
Or
no, it
Kansas City.
Kansas City.
Kansas City
for it.
City,
yeah, it was in Kansas City. They played those back-to-back games. They played Washington, who they beat, and then they played Syracuse, which they lost to. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting learning experience. Like I said in the column, like, Washington had Florida not just, you know, lost it during the conference season. That Washington win would have been, you know, one of their strongest points for making the tournament. It would have been one of the strongest lines on the resume. So you can't lose from playing these games, because who was going back and like, they lost to Syracuse, like, that's, you know, that's terrible. No, Syracuse was a very good team last year, and the fact that they even played them made their schedule so much stronger, and you can't lose from doing this.
Right, no, I mean, we made that case at the end of the men's basketball season, and again, when this schedule comes out, I mean, they're doing the right thing, they're scheduling the games, so,
yeah.
You know, stay this way. You know, I hope it's not like, you know, if they do go, you know, worst scenario, maybe they go 1-4, you know, I hope that's not Billy Donovan and Jeremy Fulton going, oh, well, we're going to go back to cream puff schedule.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, because you view all this and you have to think that when the 04s left, you know, Billy lacked confidence in his team because he had these freshmen coming in. He didn't, you know, he had no known quantities, really. You know, Tan Warner and Walter Hodge were the surest things on that team. So he just, you know, he sort of eased up on the schedule. He didn't schedule the difficult, you know, non-conference teams. He made the fall sort of like a ramping up period to the conference season, which is a very slow burn, I'd say, when you're playing Florida Gulf Coast and UCF. So this is a nice change in philosophy to me that I think is going to benefit in the long, you know, them in the long road. How many of those games do you think they win? Of the five, by the way.
Let's break it down. I'd say they will beat FSU at home.
Uh-huh.
They will split the games in Atlantic City. They'll lose to Michigan State and win the other game. So that's 1-2.
Are you saying they'll beat Jonathan Mitchell's Rutgers team?
Or UMass, yeah. I'll say that they beat either of those. I say they're going to lose. I say they lose Xavier at home, so they're 1-3. Syracuse is the game that's on the fence, I think, in Tampa in December. I guess I can. I'll go for two. I'll put two out there.
Right.
I think max of two though. I'm still a little cool on this basketball team.
Yeah, I mean two is more realistic. But you know, that's three losses on your schedule going into the SEC season. And if they can manage to not go 9-7, you know, in the SEC, then they'll be better off for it. But the SEC is going to be better this year just because they're going to lose twice to Kentucky.
Right. Well, the interesting thing though is you have the back-to-back games in the Legends Classic and FSU's the, you know, 4 days beforehand. So within a week,
yeah,
conceptually, possibly, they lose at losing against FSU at home, losing the Legends Classic. That could be, you know, potentially three losses in a week. Interesting to see how a team might rebound from that. Not saying they'll lose all three, but possibility.
Yeah, you'll learn a lot about the team during that
early
week.
On, yeah.
Which is something that we were not able to say for them last year.
I'd say after the season's over, I still haven't learned much.
Definitely after the SEC tournament, right?
Oh,
when Calais just disappeared.
Awful.
All right, well, let's move on to another segment here. We're going to talk about the top 10 burning questions of 2009, 2010 that we've been running through in the paper here this last half of summer session here in Gainesville. We've revealed 10 through 5. 10 was the women's basketball team. You know, can they get better? Can they make it back to the NCAA tournament, make it farther into there? Number 9 was about the off-the-field issues continuing for Florida football. And the new ones that we have not talked about on this podcast, number 8 is what kind of impact will women's lacrosse have after its initial season, which is in spring 2010, I believe. Season starts in February. Phil, you wrote that. You did a little bit of research about it. Just break down what's the issue here. What's the burning question? Why do these people care?
Lacrosse. I mean, it's just a matter of like whether or not lacrosse is going to catch on in Gainesville. You know, they have the big. We actually had one of our writers write another story because the facility's almost done. It's cost $15 million, looks beautiful.
Yeah.
Coach says it's going to be one of the best in the country, and looking at it, it's really hard to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of adding in new sports. It's been, when they kick off next year, the season opener is going to be February 2010 against Jacksonville. It'll be 13 years since there's been a new sport at UF.
Softball, right?
Softball, that's correct. So, I mean, it's kind of weird. You know, you just get used to having, you know, the sports that UF has and it doesn't have. It's almost a little weird to be adding on a new sport. So, but then again, on the other hand, it's something new. You know, people really like something new, and it's going to be a really nice stadium, something really nice to watch. And, you know, the coach, it'll be interesting to see how they play. You know, they got a really good coach. She had been, before she came to Florida in 2007, so she came on staff 2 years ago to start preparing for this moment.
Mm-hmm.
They've got, 20-plus players coming in.
24.
In the fall, that'll all be freshmen. So obviously the team's going to be young because, you know, it's the first year they've had a sport. And, I mean, it's the sport's a tough sport to break into. A lot of the teams that win are from the East, you know, the Northeast, you know. Northwestern has won the last five straight titles, but they're the only non, like, you know, New England-ish team, East Coast. You know, I think maybe there's Maryland in there, but that kind of region – other than Northwestern, all the champions have been from that region.
Wow.
And, interestingly enough, Florida is in the same conference as Northwestern.
Ooh, that's going to be fun.
Yeah, you know, it's not really a big enough sport to have, you know, necessarily, like, regions by, or conferences by, you know, region. So, there's two other SEC schools in the conference, South Carolina and Vandy. And then a bunch of other schools.
Do you picture Northwestern looking at the Florida game on their schedule, like Florida looks at Charleston Southern or whatever for football?
You have to imagine. I mean, they've won five straight titles, and this past year they went undefeated. And the last 4 years, Northwestern has won lacrosse's equivalent of the Heisman Trophy for having the best player.
Well.
So, I don't think they're shaking in their boots to think about Florida coming to town.
So, I mean, that's going to be interesting because we talked about how it'll be received or whatever. Because Florida fans, like we've said before, are spoiled. They, you know, they're used to winning programs. When you know, the men's basketball team has a down year, fans stop showing up. How are they going to – is the fact that it's new going to kind of outweigh the fact that they're probably not going to be that great?
I think you give everyone a break in some sense. I mean, I don't think anybody expects, all right, first season, you know, they're going to make the NCAA tournament or they're going to make the postseason. I mean – it's going to be 24 freshmen out there. You know, they have a pretty good coach. She's in the Lacrosse Hall of Fame. She's a good player, a good coach, or was a good player, and is now a good coach, seems to be. Jeremy Foley picks good coaches all the time. They've got a great facility. There's only going to be women's lacrosse. There's not yet any talk of adding a men's team. I mean, you know, we've kind of rumored about it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's a beautiful place. I think there's going to be a couple years, maybe this year, next year, then when those freshmen are juniors, when you now have three recruiting classes in here, yeah, it's really hard because, as I said, like, you know, Florida fans, they follow football, they follow men's basketball. Those are like the two pantheon sports. Football, you know, makes all the money. Men's basketball usually makes a little bit of money or even breaks even. And then you have all the other non-revenue sports, you know. And for those, it's usually just about who's winning at the time, you know. The softball team's won the last couple of years. You see the sport going there. You know, the baseball team's picked it up. You see the sport going there. I mean, even on the – there's even not as big of a flux, but even when I covered tennis, when they won, you know, there's not going to be thousands of people usually there. Yeah. But when they hosted NCAA tournament matches and they're good, people go out there. So, I mean, you know, 4 years from now, I think lacrosse's fate will be determined by how good the team is.
That's true. That's a good point. And it's worth noting that most of those freshmen who are coming in are from Maryland. They're from an area that is rich in lacrosse talent, I guess you could say. So it's not like they're just plucking these kids out of there. They're bringing in talented prospects, obviously not the best in the country or whatever, but as Florida, you know, gets a little more experience in the program, the name of Florida will draw some players in, I have to think. So to move on from there, let's move across the street, over there on Hull Road, to the softball team. The stadiums are pretty much directly across from each other. Our seventh burning question was, you know, how will the softball team recover from the loss of Stacey Nelson and that talented senior class? I covered the team last year, as you've probably heard if you've been listening to this podcast for a little while. I have gone on record as saying that I think they're going to be good next year. I think they'll probably make it back to the Women's College World Series, but it's going to be a much more realistic team than it has been over the last year. They're going to lose double-digit games. They're not going to lose five games anymore, you know, or three games in the regular season. They're going to lose some games. Brombacher is not going to go undefeated through 4 years of college, so, you know, pipe down that on that. So you got to expect more realistic things out of this team, but they're still going to be good. The heart of the lineup, Francesca Anaya, Kelsey Bruder, Megan Bush, Corey Brooks, and Aish Bakupa, who bat leadoff, are all still going to be here. They're all still going to be, you know, good or better than they were last year. I don't feel like any – I mean, Anaya had a great year, but I feel like that, you know, obviously that was not a breakout year. That was not an exception. I feel like the same goes for Kelsey Bruder, who had a breakout year last year, but I feel like it's going to stay steady at that. So I feel like you can expect – a lot more consistent production out of them. You know, they're not going anywhere. The issue, obviously, as we talked about, is going to be Brombacher. Can she handle the adjustment to the number one pitcher? And, you know, how will the new freshman they're bringing in to be her backup, how is she going to handle that? Is Brombacher going to have to take a much more involved role like Stacy did 2 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think you pointed out the lineup should still be good. And Brombacher, I think she has a lot of talent. It's just that transition to being, you know, the girl now.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting because there's just always kind of a worry, not like a hangover effect, because obviously they're losing good players, so it's not like they have to worry about that, but just being able to consistently be there. You know, at some point, a lot of teams that win a lot, then the next year, it's like you just kind of expect to win. You know, it's like, well, we've won a lot the last 2 years. We've only lost 10 games in the last 2 years. You know, it'll just happen.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see as the season goes on if they hit a little rough patch, because, you know, if they start, maybe they lose a series, maybe they lose a couple games, you know, and how they react to losing after having not lost a lot in the last couple years.
Yeah, that's a good point. Are they going to just expect to win? It's going to have a lot to do with the work ethic that they have going into the season. You know, will they want it just as bad? Will they want it more because they don't have, you know, Stacy Nelson and Allie Gardner with them anymore, or Kim Wallazonia? Or will they just become a little more complacent? That's going to be the issue, really. I think maybe even more than Brombacher's success, I feel like that's going to be a big issue, because that'll play into her. I mean, that will play into her success as well, certainly. So let's move on. Number six, Phil, you did this one. Why don't you introduce it?
Yeah, we're talking about the UF football defense. The question I broke it down to, will the UF defense rank among the best ever? I mean, it sounds a little absurd, but then when you think about how the season's shaping up, it doesn't really seem so absurd. I mean, they returned the entire 2-deep from last season. So, you know, the top 22 defensive players from last season are coming back, and they're just a season older, a season wiser, a season more experienced. So usually that doesn't mean they're going to go get any worse, you know?
You would think.
You'd usually think, and it's very easy to argue that they're going to have an easier schedule this year even than they had last year.
I have no trouble arguing that point at all, actually.
Last year they ended up having the second toughest schedule in the country, which is probably helped by, you know, facing Oklahoma and facing Alabama in the SEC Championship game.
Yeah.
But, yeah, last year they averaged 12.9 points per game. So, I mean, improving upon that, I think single digits is certainly something they'll shoot for. I don't know if they'll get it.
I mean, they'll shoot for zero, Phil.
Well, they'll shoot for zero, right. But, I mean, you have to remember, a lot of times they were also hurt by the fact that they're winning these games huge.
Yeah.
And so you got the second team, the third team out there.
Yeah.
Even though the backups are really good and they've been there, when you get the third string out there and you're up 40 points, they're not really worried about giving up field goals and, you know, things like
this. Yeah, when Wandy Pierre-Louis and Marquis Anderson are out there guarding, you know, the second string, you know, whatever, Kentucky quarterback, you know, if they sneak in a field goal or a touchdown, it's not a prime concern.
Right. I think one of the most interesting facts, actually, that I found out when I was doing this is in 14 games last season, the defense allowed only 58 first-half points. Because you figure in the first half, they're really still trying. Every game's still kind of in it.
Yeah.
All the starters are still playing. Yes, was there some puff teams on that? Absolutely. But 58 first-half points in 14 games, I mean, that's less than 5 points a game in the first half.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's an easy way. The offense, if it struggles, they're still winning, you know, or if they're winning big, then that's how you get these halftime scores of like 21-3, 21-6. And from a momentum standpoint, being able to stop a team early is huge in college football.
Absolutely. So in terms of ranking among the best ever, what do you think they'll have to do?
That's just kind of rough. You know, because even, you know, this team, you thought it was great. You know, they seemed to have so many turnovers. As I looked up, they had 26 interceptions in 2008, which was tied for tops in the country. But yet, they still had a little bit of that bend don't break thing, you know. While they finished the year ninth in the country in total defense, they allowed 285 yards a game. In rushing defense and passing defense separately, they were only 15th in rushing defense and 20th in passing defense.
Mm-hmm.
I think the rushing defense, so they allowed 105 yards a game last season. I think that's a lot. I think also, you know, if they want to be the best ever or even improve on that this year, I don't think that's very hard. I think, again, you're kind of killed by teams running the ball when it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
So, you know, 105, under 100, definitely not shocking. 20th in passing defense, allowed 179 yards a game passing. Then there's the other side of that coin, though. When teams are trailing by 28 points, all they're going to do is sit back there and throw the ball. Mm-hmm. So 179 yards. If you want to be the best defense ever, I don't know. I guess I'd have to go back and look at what numbers have been put up, what are records. But, I mean, if you get under 100 yards, if you allow under 100 yards of rushing, say under 175, under 150 yards passing, you know, so that's under 250 yards of total offense, and you allow, I don't know, 10 points or less, I mean, that's got to stack you up there among the best.
Certainly one of the best we've seen recently, I would think.
Sure, for sure. I mean, even so, I mean, the truth of it is, in the end, it's not really going to matter what numbers they put up. It's really just about their ability to, if the offense struggles, keep them in the game or blow games open or swing momentum. There's just so many games where, you know, the teams would be going down, you know, down the field and then there's an interception or there's a goal line stand. We saw in the championship game, there's numerous examples of this. And so, you know, they only gave up 14 points to Oklahoma's offense. Oklahoma came into that game averaging 54 points a game. Now, they're going to score 50 points on UF? No. But, I mean, to only allow 14 points against the Heisman Trophy winning quarterback is simply amazing. I mean, you really can't. And now they're just working through the offseason. The only thing, as the entire team has to worry about, is complacency. But as Urban and Charlie Strong will talk about, when you have backups that are really good, that can challenge for positions, if you're the starter, you know, I realize, I feel like Urban's mouthpiece here, but it's true, the things that he says. If you're a starter and you're slacking off, well, all right, you're not going to start anymore. You know, like, there's guys behind them that are going to push for spots. I think the biggest key is going to be the interior defensive line, the same issues they worried about a year ago. Torrey Davis, who made a couple big goal line tackles, never really fit in, has been off the team now since May. So, yeah, but now it's time for, you know, as we spoke about earlier in this podcast, Omar Hunter, time for him to, you know, earn that scholarship, as Urban will say. If he can come in and be a beast in the middle, you know, because Matt Patchen is now back on the offensive line. He was a big guy who filled a hole in the middle of the interior defensive tackle in the first half of the season before he got hurt. The ends, you never have to worry about. You've got Carlos Dunlap. You've got Justin Traddow, Jermaine Cunningham.
Yeah.
I mean, the ends are solid, but you have to have that interior defensive tackle guys that's going to help stop that rushing game.
Yeah, absolutely. And that'll be something interesting to see if they improve on that. I think certainly if they get more consistent play, really, then they'll, I mean, that 100 yards, less than 100 yards per game is certainly within reach, but that's going to be a big part of it. But I'm glad you mentioned the thing about, you know, complacency being more about the pressure from their backups. Like, you can talk about complacency and like, oh, they're going to overcome that just because these guys want to win so bad. But really, what motivates you more than anything is like a lack of job security. Like, if you can just get knocked out of your position because you have somebody behind you, like you think in the secondary, probably 5-6 guys in there who could start on nearly any team in the country. I don't feel, you know, incorrect saying that necessarily.
No, absolutely. I mean, the safeties are ridiculous.
The safeties,
especially, there's 5 guys that could, like, you know, including the 2 starters, those top 5 guys could all, at least 4 of them could definitely start for any team in the SEC.
Yeah, so when you have that kind of pressure on you, you're certainly more motivated to play well, you're certainly more motivated to go out there and train hard and get prepared for every game, because, you know, if you're not on the field, that hurts your stock as, you know, one of the best players in the country, as a potential NFL prospect. So these people are going to care about that, if only in a selfish way even, in addition to whatever team motives and, you know, being the best team in the country that they, you know, winning another national championship that they care about. So let's move on from that. Move on to the number 5 burning question we have, which is about how UF will replace the loss of Percy Harvin's, you know, his athletic ability, his playmaking ability especially. Because Harvin did everything. He was one of a kind, as I wrote in today's paper. He could come out of the backfield, he could line up a receiver. I don't think they can directly replace him with one player yet. Andre DeBose, the freshman, is hyped up as having those abilities, and I think, you know, maybe 2-3 years down the line he'll be able to do some of that, but I think to expect that out of him now is unfair. I think what, you know, fans should be expecting is a, you know, replacement by committee. They should be expecting Jeff Demps and Chris Rainey to step up their game in the backfield. They should be expecting this unproven, you know, questionable receiving core to do what they can out on the field. There's not going to be one replacement for Percy.
No, that's absolutely true. I remember Mike McCall actually wrote a great column about this during the spring about just the expectations on Andre DeBose, and actually talked to Percy and what it was like when he came here. And I remember one of the best points I've made in that is when Percy came a couple years ago, he was this big talent and really hyped up guy, but he kind of came in with Tim Tebow. So, like, you could be hyped up, but Tim Tebow was like, you know, it's kind of like he just kind of shouldered a lot of the weight. You know, it's like what, you know, Tim took all the criticism, or the questions, at least, you know, what's going to happen. It was on Tim's shoulders, and so people weren't so worried about looking at what Percy was doing, or if they were, it's just not as much as it would have been had he come in alone. They got Andre DeBose coming in alone. He is supposed to be, and Urban's not done him any help in this regard. He's supposed to be the stud, you know? Like, Urban's hinted a little bit at, you know, that you can't replace him with one guy. You can't replace Percy, and it's true. I think Percy, when we look back a long time from now, maybe I think some injuries limited what he could do, but even with the injuries, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And he's going to be maybe one of those once-in-a-generation type guys. I really believe just his playmaking ability is something you're not going to see a lot of Florida or anywhere, just the way he changed the game.
Yeah.
And you had Tim and him on the same field. Now, obviously, Tim's still here, but I don't think Andre DeBose walks in with all this hype. And if you remember, Percy Harvin, it's not like he was the stud he is now in his freshman year. You know, he had a couple catch and runs, UCF, and towards the end of the season, he really started to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously that was coming from Chris Leak, you know, back in his freshman year. But I just, it's not going to be one guy, that's for sure. Andre DeBose, they're going to put him in the Percy position. I don't think that's going to quite have the same results. And the biggest thing, you made this point, I completely agree, is the way Percy Harvin made other teams worry about him when he was on the field.
Yeah, when he was on the field, you have no idea what's coming. Whereas, you know, if Florida sends out Jeff Demps and two receivers, you kind of know what to expect. Like, you know, if Percy were on the field as one of the receivers or at Demps' position, you didn't know what was coming. They could do anything in that. They could run Tebow out to in motion and put Percy behind center and snap the ball to him. The options were limitless with Percy. They're going to be a little bit more limited without him this year. I think you're going to see more conventional position roles, I'd say. Like, the running backs will be running backs and the receivers will be receivers. I feel like that's a pretty safe statement because none of the guys at receiver right now have shown that kind of versatility to me. Deontay Thompson is supposedly, you know, he can take the sweeps or whatever, but I don't feel like Thompson has ever really come through on the promise that he had last year. I don't know. I don't know what to expect from any of the receivers right now.
Right. Well, see, that's another thing that kind of is worrisome then, though, because a big part of sometimes U.S. offense was the sweep, or at least, you know, having teams thinking about the sweep. You know, I think there's just a lot of pressure on DeBose right now.
Yeah.
And interesting, I caught this actually just before we came in. I wanted to see. Nobody else has picked it up, but the Orlando Sentinel reported, I guess they put this out yesterday at 3 o'clock, that DeBose has been limited in off-season workouts with a hamstring injury. They say it's according to a team source, but they say that he'll be back full, ready to go for fall 2 days. So take that for what you will. I mean, some sources telling the Orlando Sentinel this could be completely true. I don't know how big being limited in off-season workouts will ever affect Andre DeBose. Obviously, he wasn't here in January. I think he's here. If he's ready for 2 days, I don't think it's a big deal.
He's coming right into that Percy position, though, if he's dealing with injury already.
He's
ready to go.
Yeah. I mean, I think if this hamstring is anything, that's not a good sign because you never want to start your career injured and having to deal. Like, you know, because then you're rehabbing while the team's preparing, and then you're preparing while the team's already prepared. And it's like, you know, it's not like you've been here and you know what's going on. But that's what happens sometimes with these guys that are so slippery, slick, you know, making all those cuts, you're very much more viable to injury. And heaven forbid, this is just worst case, imagine if Andre DeBose went down with an injury, like, you know, even long term. I don't wish this upon the man, certainly at all. You never want to wish for injuries, but I mean, their depth, I'd say the biggest key is their depth of wide receiver is nowhere it was. You know, David Nelson stepping up now into the fray, but this team was really good last year because David Nelson, who was unknown but then turned out to be good, was down on the depth chart. You know, who is this year's David Nelson is the big thing.
Well, I talked about this just in the office, off the record, off the air the other night. You know, saying somebody was hyping up David Nelson in the office, you know, saying that he's a good receiver or whatever. He has a lot of potential. David Nelson was like the fourth receiver on last year's team. You know, he was being guarded, therefore you would think, by like a safety coming up or, you know, a nickelback or whatever. He's not being guarded by the top-tier guys. He's not having to run those one or two receiver routes. He's different. He functions differently. Who is the fourth receiver on this year's team? Like you said, who is this year's David Nelson? It's interesting to see, but what I want to move to real quick before we wrap this up,
sure.
What do you expect out of the running backs, out of Demps and Rainey primarily?
I think they're going to hurt the most by that defensive coordinator not having a game plan for Percy Harvin type thing. I think Demps and Rainey, they're slippery, they can get free, and they're always a home run threat. I think that's a big thing to them.
Yeah.
But I think for 3 yards, you're going to want Emmanuel Moody in the backfield.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the pitch out to Demps, it's like it could go for none or it could go for 60 yards, and that's really useful sometimes. But now when you have teams that are game planning, you know, assuming Andre DeBose doesn't turn out to be, you know, the best college football player or rookie ever or something, you know, you have these defensive coordinators that are going to say, all right, we're gonna make sure Jeff Demps, Chris Rainey, and Aaron Hernandez don't beat us.
Yeah.
And then we're going to make, you know, Deontay Thompson, Riley Cooper, if he doesn't sign a baseball contract, and David Nelson and Carl Moore beat us. And we're gonna make sure the team doesn't run.
Yeah.
We're gonna make you throw the ball, and we're gonna make you throw the ball to the wide receivers.
Yeah, I think that is certainly a decent game plan that you throw up against this team. Whether or not you can actually force them to do that, is something
to,
you know.
Well, that's what, you know, Steve Adazio and Urban Meyer get the big bucks for.
Yeah,
there, you know.
Yeah, but that's the dream situation. That's the, you know, that's the game plan if you're coming into a game against Florida, is that you know, you don't let Demps or Rainey break the home run, because I really don't think they're tough enough runners to, you know, make those little runs, to get those, you know, just to gain yards. I think it's home run, you know, 10, 12 yards, 60 yards, or zero, or loss.
Right.
Like, I don't see them just grinding out the ball. I feel like you have to bring in Moody for that.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing is, though, they're helped by the fact that there's two of them. You know, like, if Jeff Demps and Chris Rainey each get 10 touches, that's 20 carries. That could be for, like, you know, 180 yards or something, you know, like, so they kind of added up. But, yeah, I mean, on, you know, 3rd-and-1, that's probably still going
to
be Tim. You know,
yeah,
that's going
to
be Tim Tebow up the middle.
Yeah.
I
was going to bring that because, you know, either way, you have that fail-safe. Like, I need a couple yards, I just run Tebow. So
right.
If they stick to that and, you know, they feel, you know, better about doing that now that Percy's gone, or now that he's, you know, the big threat or whatever. He still led the team in rushing last year anyway, so.
Right. Well, that's ridiculous. But also, Percy didn't play in 2 games. I think Percy probably
would
have beat him.
He
happy.
Would, yeah. He
yeah.
was close to
him.
But.
I think the interesting thing is going to be that I just forgot what I was going to say.
Lost train of thought there.
I completely lost my train of thought. The wide receivers.
You said you were going to be dry coming into this because recording on an afternoon. You,
wow,
you
rainy afternoon. The thought completely
receivers
just
anything?
Flew out of my head. Oh,
nope. You ain't got it. I'll ask you a question then.
Yeah, go ahead.
Who steps up out of this receiving corps? Who steps up?
Deontay Thompson showed a little glimpses. I'm just not sure if. I'm not sold that anyone steps up. I think it's going to be even more by committee than maybe it was a year ago. You know, like,
who's the number one receiver come opening day?
Riley Cooper.
If he stays.
I mean, it'll be labeled, you know, what's going to be written all fall? It's going to be Deontay Thompson or David Nelson. You know, that's what's going to be written, and that's what maybe will be said. But I think a lot of it's going to be talked about how, you know, it'll be by committee, and I think wide receivers coach Billy Gonzalez is probably not going to be baited into naming number one guy because, you know, you don't want to really add that pressure to them. Who do you think it's going to be, Adam?
I mean,
straight
I feel like the team's leading receiver is going to be Aaron Hernandez.
Well, okay,
yeah,
true. I was counting him out.
Yeah,
I was calling him
out. Yeah, that's a trick thing on my part. I thought I'd get that out there before I forgot it like you did. But, jeez, like, David Nelson, I think, has to be.
Right.
So,
but remember that before, like, you know, the last 3 games of last season, David Nelson was no joke. It was like, oh, David Nelson's going in the game. All right, they're going to roll a bubble screen, and he's going to block over there. Like, David Nelson, like, caught, like, single-digit catches, maybe on one hand, and then catches, like, some of the biggest catches of the year.
Yeah.
I mean, it really, like, he had breakout. But, got the point. I got the point I wanted. It's not even really that great. I built it up too much. But the thing is, we remember, obviously, and that's all we can remember, the Jeff Demps and Chris Rainey from a year ago.
Yeah.
They're a year older. So, I mean, it's not like they got a whole new skill set. It's not like, you know, I don't think they're going to, it's hard for people that fast to get any faster, really. But, you know, maybe their cuts are sharper. Maybe, certainly they're at full strength. Chris Rainey was hurt by the end of the season.
That's true.
And had surgery after the season. and may have been bothered by that more than they let on, I'm pretty sure. And then Demps was hurt by Rainey not being there. You know, like, then Demps is the only guy doing the slashing, cutting, going downfield. So you got both of them hopefully healthy and ready to go from the beginning. And remember, last season, it was midway through the year when they really got, they hit the ground running. It was, like, Jeff Demps did some things in the Miami game. He blocked a punt and stuff. But it was at Arkansas when they both ran for over 100 yards, which is a big deal. When it really kind of kick-started the, Demps and Rainey show.
That's true. That's a good point. But to me, the thing that's going to be most important for them, obviously being healthy, but I feel like for them to really develop as better running backs, better overall players, and not just home run threats, they need to get bigger. They need to get stronger. That was one thing Percy did coming into this last year, is he just got huge upper body strength. The speed was already there. He added the muscle. He was a lot, you know, he was a lot stronger. He could break some more stuff. He could reel in some balls that he couldn't otherwise. I think that's going to be very important for their development.
Yeah, and I wouldn't, I mean, I'm sure, obviously, I'm sure the strength that has worked with them.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I don't think, well, first of all, I don't think they have the variety of Percy Harvin. Nobody, I'm not saying that you said that. But also, they just seem like, they don't seem like that body mold almost. You know,
I
like,
agree.
I'm sure maybe they can be built that way, but they just seem like those, like, slippery, thin, not huge guys. And yeah, those are also susceptible to injury, but it's like risk reward. It's like, I could run a 60-yard touchdown here, or I could sprain my ankle.
that's the epitome of risk reward.
I mean, it's rough, but I mean, you look like Demps was hampered every once in a while. Rainey was hampered every once in a while. It's like, it's these small things. It's these nicks. It's, they didn't always miss game time, but they weren't always at their 100% potential.
Yeah. All right. And that's it for this edition of the Top 10 Burning Questions. Come back next week, and I guess at that point we might have numbers 4 through 1. So look forward to that. And now we're going to move on to our weekly awards segment. All right, we're going to give out our Reggie Nelson Awards for Excellence in the Field of Sport and Kyle Jackson Bad Angles of the Week, which go to one good thing and one bad thing that we saw in the world of sports last week. Phil, I'll let you start off with your Kyle Jackson.
Yeah, we're gonna end happy today, so we'll start on the sad side of things. As earlier broken today, my Kyle Jackson Award is going to go to this list of 103 Major League Baseball players that have that tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs during the 2003 season. A couple more names off the list came out today who were on the Red Sox during the 2003 season, David Ortiz and Manny Ramirez, who is now obviously on the Los Angeles Dodgers. I just wish, as a sports fan, that the list would just come out already. It's not going to, for a multitude of reasons. First of all, it's like a court order sealing it, so these are like serious leaks. Like, if it came out who was giving the leaks, I'm pretty sure bad stuff would happen. And like, the players, as much as they say they want transparency, you know, they don't really want it out there.
Yeah.
You know, it's, everybody talks about, I really do find it funny though, how like, people who are on this list, like, have come out and like, said stuff, bad stuff beforehand about steroid users. It's like, you know you're on the list, like, like, what are you thinking? Like, it's never going to come out? Like, in this age, like, everything comes out eventually. It's just really ridiculous.
Well, they were promised it wouldn't come out, so I don't know if they're getting a little brave, but they should be smart enough
to
know.
I mean, if I am them, I'm not going to lie, I'm mad at the players' union for not having this list destroyed and the samples destroyed and all that. But, I mean, it really would just be better if we just do it once, you just have a... It's kind of like the Mitchell report. You know, there was backlash for a couple weeks, in a little while, but it's just done because... As some one of the analysts said on ESPN this morning, it's like this trickle-down effect, and I think it's going to keep coming over time as reporters break it.
Absolutely.
We dwell so much on these. You know, if 100 come out, we're going to freak out about all, you know, I'm not saying they're all big-time players, but say there's 20, even 20 big-time players. We're going to freak out about those 20, but all at once for a week, even however long. But now each time, it's like the next 10 days on ESPN are going to be Manny Ramirez and David Ortiz, and they're going to be asked about it all the time, all the time, all the time, all the time. And if all 100 came out, then we talk about it, we get over it, and it's not gone, but it's not this like day-to-day trickle-out effect.
Yeah, and at this point, you're just dragging a couple people's names through the mud, which, I mean, they deserve for using steroids or whatever, but you do it individually, and these guys get more pressure and everything. It's, I don't know, this to me is like, it's so disappointing that we even have to live through this time in baseball, that everybody, I mean, you know, Ortiz is a big deal, whatever, Ramirez we already kind of knew about because of the fertility drug he was taking that got him a 50-game suspension, to which he was applauded when he came back. That, to me, is the biggest joke about this. You think Boston fans are going to turn on Ortiz? You think anybody turns on Ramirez? No, because they don't really care. Everybody does this stupid, like, self-righteous, oh, I hate what steroids have done to the game. Not when it's your player. When it's your beloved David Ortiz, when it's your Manny Ramirez, you excuse the guy. You cheer him on when he comes out there anyway.
And how terrible is it that Manny apparently tested positive in 2003, waits till there's rules in effect, and then tests positive again? That's just kind of like... sells about everything about Manny Ramirez.
I can't, like, I this to me is like the one, like, there's a lot of reasons I can't, you know, really get into baseball that much. This is one of the reasons, and it's why baseball fans are disappointed to me in this regard. Like, can you not, like, you know, Boston fans, I'm sure when, you know, A-Rod's steroids results came out or whatever, we're all, you know, up on that, you know, throwing it in the face of Yankee fans. But now, what, you know, are the Boston fans going to be like, yeah, it's not that big of a deal. It was back a while ago. These guys helped them win those World, you know, that first World Series especially that broke that 86-year, you know, drought. Like, these were their heroes in Boston. Do you really think that the steroid uses that they have condemned so different, you know, so hardly before, do you think it's going to have an impact, you know, on their view of Ortiz or Ramirez, really?
No, I don't think so.
It's incredibly disappointing to me, but it's incredibly correct. I mean... It's sad to see. But it's funny to me, though, that Bonds, and maybe it's just because Barry Bonds' personality was just, he was such a jerk about everything.
Right.
But, you know, everybody uses that as, like, the reason to hate Bonds. Like, yeah, well, he used steroids. Like, how can you like that? How can you support a cheater? They throw out the word cheater like it's, you know, whatever. And then now they've got cheaters playing for them, and yet they support them without, you know, without fail, without even a second, you know, doubt of their allegiance. That turned into my Kyle Jackson stuff.
That's all right,
man. I was a little more angry about it than you were, apparently. But I'll give mine, which I'm actually less passionate about than yours was, I guess, to recruiting coverage as a whole. I was at Friday Night Lights, like I said. I'm not a recruiting writer myself. But the recruiting sites and the papers and websites that get really into the recruiting coverage, it's a little unsettling how they do it. Like, you know, they're following these kids around. They've got their huge lists of these guys, and they're, you know, up against these kids with video cameras, you know, not 2 feet away from them, asking them all these questions. And these kids are, you know, these kids are high school kids. If you were to ask me questions about my NFL future as an 18-year-old, I don't know what I'd say. I feel bad for these kids.
I would say something ridiculous. That's what I would have said.
I would, and that's one thing I feel like we do as people in the
and then
press.
we judge these high school recruits. It's really not even fair to them. It's like, oh, we're going to tell you how good you are, and then we're going to ask you how good you think you are, and you're going to agree with us,
yeah.
And then we're going to call you cocky, so
yeah.
Hold on.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point about it. And the whole thing is just, like, it's so overdone. Like I said, it was a circus at that place last Friday night. There's so many people there covering it, so many recruits really just hoping to prove themselves and going all out and doing whatever they can on this night because they know it's going to have a big impact on their future. And that's just kind of sad for me to see, and, you know, I feel like, I don't know, the whole concept of covering recruiting to me is not, like, firm. It's not on firm ground. Everything's a little bit shaky. Everything's a little bit different than usual sports coverage. In addition, these kids are here to, you know, work out and impress coaches, and then since we can't arrange interviews with them or whatever, because that's against, you know, against the rules, we have to just kind of grab them as they're leaving the camp and, you know, pull them over in the, you know, outside the swamp and talk to them, you know, people they don't, you know, people we're not familiar with, people they're not familiar with us. You know, it's just a weird footing, it's a weird ground. I feel weird covering it, I'd say. I don't know, it's just recruiting coverage as a whole to me. It's not something I could certainly ever see myself doing on down the line. Since you apparently don't have anything to say about that, I guess I'm going to move on and give out my Reggie Nelson Award. I'm going to give mine to the men's hoops team for the schedule that they just revealed. We talked about it earlier. I think it's a very encouraging sign. It's a step in the right direction. It's maybe the first sign of Billy hoping to turn the program around and make something of it.
All right. I think that's good for them, too. I don't have as much to say about men's basketball.
Clearly.
I'm going to give my Reggie Nelson, which is, this is semi-bittersweet, right, but a little bit happy when it happened at least, to the Tampa Bay Rays, who sadly, I feel like I can't award them after that awful affair last night. They dropped 2-3 to the Yankees. But I got to give them some credit. Or maybe I just give the credit to myself since they win when I'm there. I'm just going to put it out that way.
That would be good for all the Kyle Jackson we've given you on this
show. Yeah, probably. But Tuesday night, my girlfriend is a Yankees fan, and I drove down to Tampa, made the two-hour drive down there to see the Rays take on the Yankees. And that game could not have been any sweeter to watch with someone who was a Yankees fan, especially someone who you have had a lot of trash talk with, before he went to the game.
She doesn't listen to this, does she?
I don't know. Yeah. I'm not going to tell her to, though. But just like the way the game, I mean, you have Derek Jeter and A-Rod throwing the ball over the first baseman's head. You have Nick Swisher sliding and catching, you know, missing a ball that then goes into foul territory, but he missed it off his glove in fair territory. You got people running to a triple. They ended up winning 6-2. And it was just, it's a great game to watch, and it was a lot of fun because I really put my pride out on the line, and I had a lot of fun.
But what kind of winner are you, generally, when your team wins?
You might call me slightly obnoxious, I don't know. Would you agree with that, Adam?
I mean, you might call you slightly obnoxious if that happens, I don't know.
I mean, you know, I've been known to yell in the car, beat on my car dashboard, when I'm by myself, of course. Possibly some text messages, some Facebook statuses. You know, when I win, everybody knows. I'll put it that way.
As you said before, Phil wins big and he loses big. And when he loses, as the Rays did twice in this series, he does not take it well.
No.
So, I guess the sheer joy that win gave you is worth the Reggie Nelson for you. So, that wraps it up for today's show. We'll be back at some point next week. Next week is the last week of the summer semester, but we'll be around putting out some more papers covering the football teams, two-a-days and everything that's leading up to the football season and the start of the other fall sports. So look forward to that. Check back next week. Send any feedback you have on this show to sports@alligator.org, especially as it pertains to our top 10 burning questions, and we'll answer it on the show. Thanks for listening.